So I would like now to go on to a somewhat later stage, and that is at the point when the Collective Measures Committee was established under the Uniting for Peace resolution. And you, of course, were involved in drafting that resolution. Could you give me a little bit of your thinking in the various aspects of the Uniting for Peace resolution, that is, particularly the establishment of this Collective Measures Committee? What did you have in mind at that point?
Well, what I suppose we were doing in effect was taking advantage of the experience in the Korean business, where a lot of nations did come and help in a limited way, but they were behind the action in Korea, and so that we could ask nations in the event of a war situation, or a threat of war situation, to come to the aid of the party, as it were. And we thought it would be a wise thing to formalize that by the creation of a Collective Measures Committee, which would, as it were, write the rules of the game, how it could be done and how they should be called upon and so on. And that really is pretty much in the report of the Collective Measures Committee, which I can't very well add to. The British were somewhat reluctant. They were the most reluctant, I think, of the members of the committee in going too far beyond the original wording of the Charter of the UN. They had more than any other countries I remember, although Colson was their representative and was a very able and nice man. They had more of the attitude of EUR, as it were, than the International Organizations Department in the State Department.
Now, again, the recommendations of the Collective Measures Committee seem to come close to the Charter provisions in Articles 42 and 43, but they're clearly different. What was the distinction you were trying to make there?
Well, I think the distinction is the difference between mandatory action and voluntary action. If you operate under the General Assembly and under the Uniting for Peace resolution, well, then you're doing it not as a duty, as it were, but as a voluntary act in behalf of the general good and peace, in effect.
So, in a sense, the committee worked on the assumption that the military force provided under Articles 42 and 43 was not going to be available.
That's right.
So this was
I'll put it in another way. Not that it was not necessarily going to be available, but that there might be cases where it was unavailable because of the operations of the veto, and therefore this would take care of the situation. This is, of course, at the time when the Soviet Union was not playing ball with the other states, and it was felt this was so that there would not be a powerless United Nations simply because of the veto of one power.
Now,
one state.
The report of the Collective Measures Committee provides, or it has the idea, that there should be something called a military executive authority.
Yeah.
Can you give any background on that idea? How did that originate?
Well, I guess we just thought it up.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was for the same reason that we should, the idea of collective action under the, something like the United Nations should not be rendered powerless by the action of a single member.
Was the fairly autocratic conduct of the war by General MacArthur an element in your thinking, that is, that there should be some...
Well, it may have been in certain people's minds. It was certainly never articulated.
Never articulated.
No, not by any members of the Collective Measures Committee that I've ever heard speak of it. That's so said. That was never so said.
But it then it was an effort to deal with the problem of direction of a military undertaking by the United Nations, really, without defining whether it's
that's right.
General Assembly or Security Council, in recognition that the Security Council would, or the General Assembly were two large organizations to do this. Was that your thinking?
Well, no, rather, I think more it was the idea was to get the nations of the United Nations thinking about the possibilities of being called upon for military action, and to get them to organize themselves in that regard. And some states took that quite literally, as I understand it, and went ahead and created within their own military world, their own military establishment, a force, a kind of a special kind of, I don't know exactly what you call it now, but we used to have a name of it. They have a group within their own military establishment which was designed for operations under the United Nations auspices in case there was a common action again, as there was in Korea. Mm-hmm.
And the committee report also provides for, I believe it's a group of military, it's called military observers, I forget the actual title, but what was the intention there?
I don't think there was any greater intention was in the language of
the report.
Of the report.
Mm-hmm.
No. People kept asking, was there a, did we have the idea of a legion, an international legion to be ready at hand? And we would answer that, no. We weren't trying to get up a legion, a fire legion type of thing. But simply to have countries made aware of the fact that they might be called upon for action in the event of a UN resolution calling on them to do it.
And was there considerable satisfaction on the American side with this report when it was published?
I think so. Now, it's hard to know what the Pentagon thought of it. They took it seriously, I think. But whether or not they really thought this would do any good because they were autocratic themselves, I don't know. But we talked to them. I was an extremely able Assistant Secretary of Defense, and his name I've forgotten, he died. What's his name? Anyway, he was awfully good, and he was a spokesman for this. Frank, and he was in favor of this, but whether or not he represented the Pentagon as a whole, I don't know.
Because that is a question I wanted to ask. In particular, the military executive authority that's foreseen in that would take over the command and control function, which in fact the U.S. military has always been very reluctant to put under an international authority.
That's right.
So you did have some consultation with the...
Oh, yes. Oh, sure.
With the Pentagon on that at that time.
Yeah.
And
the British were equally afraid of that, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, did you have the impression then that on the American side that there was any willingness on the part of the Pentagon actually to designate certain troops as is foreseen in the report?
Well, their response to this, we asked each country, and their response was that the whole Army, Navy, and Marines would be at the disposal of it, and they would work it out, but they didn't want to have a segregated group. That was my understanding of what their general position was.
I see. Because it's also foreseen in the report that the United Nations could provide technical training, so to speak, for the individual countries as they did designate forces for UN service. That was never taken seriously, as far as you know, on the American
by the Pentagon? Yeah. I don't think so. No.
Never.
No. They had no objection to it. And they were fully aware of what was said here and what was being said by me as the fellow who was representing the U.S. That they were willing to go along with what we said, but they, I think, in the back of their mind, they said, you know, this is it.
Now, in the report, there is no mention of the Military Staff Committee. Did you give thought at that point to any role for the Military Staff Committee? Or
no, although we didn't. I don't know exactly how to answer that question. I really don't know my real answer. But the Military Staff Committee was, of course, we were represented on the Military Staff Committee, and they had meetings all the time. But I never knew what went on in those meetings, and nor did I ever know how seriously the upper reaches of the Pentagon took the Military Staff Committee.
Perhaps it was too closely identified with the Security Council, and only the Security Council.
Yes, I think probably.
That may have been one of the...
But the Pentagon was not against this report at all. I think they were in favor of it because they thought of it as being a possibility in the event of a big war of getting more countries on the U.S. side. And obviously that would be helpful.
Right. How long did you remain concerned with in the department with U.N. matters after the report was...
Well, I'm going to have to think of dates. I left the department in 53, I think. Mm-hmm.
And I think this was probably 52.
Yeah, this is dated 51.
51, yeah. Because the reason I ask that is my question, my real question is, again, to what extent was there satisfaction in the Department of State or disappointment in the results of this report?
I think there was general satisfaction, except they didn't think it was a very important thing.
Really?
I think that would be true. Mr. Acheson made a speech which I wrote a paragraph for him. And he talked to me about it. He said, you really want me to say this? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, I'll say it. And I can't remember what it was. It was a good speech, and this was something at the end of the speech. If I had the thing here, I could show it to you, but I don't.
But it did relate to...
It did relate to...
To collective measures.
The idea of collective measures by the UN.
Now I want to go back just a minute to the conduct and at the end of the war in Korea, the armistice negotiations that took place between the military commanders. To what extent was the International Organization Office in the State Department involved in those negotiations?
Not at all.
Not at all. And I think that probably answers my next question, because, and that is, to what extent was there any consultation between the military commanders and the United Nations on what the terms of the armistice should be?
And the United Nations itself, Secretary right. General's mm-hmm. office, as it were.
Right, right.
I doubt there was any.
So, in effect, there seems to have been very little actual connection between New York and the United Nations and the conduct of either the war or the conduct of the armistice negotiations, as far as you can remember.
I think that's right. I think that during the war, it was Hickson and his weekly meetings. And I don't think the mission in New York had anything to do with that at all.
Right, right. And that, of course, was only with those countries that were contributing troops.
Yes.
And not the others. After the armistice was actually agreed, there remained a very serious problem of the prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, my question is, what was the role of the State Department in dealing with this problem, which was in the field, of course, handled by the military? It was a political question, though, in many respects. Were you?
I was not involved in it at all.
Again?
No.
If it had been anybody, it would have been Hickerson.
Would have been Hickerson.
And his group. And the same situation prevailed there, while the North Koreans were making various severe propaganda attacks
mm-hmm.
against the UN command. As far as you know, the UN input into handling this prisoner of war question was
non-existent.
Was non-existent. Now, just going to the present, I'd just like to get your assessment as to whether this was the right way that the war should have been handled.
The Korean War?
Yes. There was a UN flag there.
Well, of course, there had to be somebody in the State Department who was the focal point for meetings between the other countries mm-hmm. who were contributing troops or other helping things. I mean, who were not confined to troops. And I think that probably having the Assistant Secretary for United Nations Affairs would be as good as any person within the State Department to be the go-between, to be the person who would talk to them.
Yeah. My question really goes more to the aspect of the consultation with the United Nations and really to the question of command and control. Was there, at the time, any sense in the State Department that the United Nations should have more influence on the conduct of the war or of the negotiations to end the war?
The United Nations, that is the Secretary General?
The Secretary General, or, for example, the Armistice Committee, which was established.
Yeah.
Or the Ceasefire Committee.
I don't know the answer to that.
No. It was not something that really bothered you.
No.
Because if something like this military executive authority had been established, then it would have been a different situation entirely.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
And looking to the present situation, if this report were going to be written again, would you feel that there should be even greater insistence on the establishment of some kind of a UN authority which could be effective but at the same time maintain the influence of the United Nations on the conduct of military activities?
Yeah, I think so. If I understand your question, I'm not sure that I...
Well, it's the whole question of command and control, whether or not there can be any multilateral control over a military action.
Well, I should think, if you think of it in the abstract, that there should be a central point which would be, have representation on a kind of a central committee of those nations which were contributing forces to take care of problems which would arise because of the fact that there were multinational forces. I would think that would be a desirable thing. Mm. Now, how it should be set up, I just don't know. Well, that's the only reaction I have to your question.
Now, there's one part.
There's always going to be one nation which contributes the maximum, the greatest number of force, and who is more directly involved in any war. And so you're always going to have a problem of having a single person to make decisions rather than having decisions made by a group. And so it would be a not too many fire chiefs. So it would be a workable arrangement.
That's one of the interesting aspects of the idea in your report of a military executive authority, because it would bring the contributing, troop contributing countries in a rather limited group into a situation where they would be able to give not tactical control, but at least guidance. Which seems to me to be a very good idea.
Yeah, very good idea, and very important, you see. Because when you take the situation of the 39th parallel, or whatever that number was, should that be crossed, should the military go farther, the military commanders go farther than the nations who had troops there want them to go? And that's
And in the case of Korea, that decision was made entirely by the commander in the field, right? And you in the State Department had no control on that.
Well, control may not be the right word, but the State Department would be talking to the President of the United States in situations of this sort.
Yeah.
And that would be the Secretary of State. And more and more would be the fellow who would talk to the president about that. The president gets involved in these things in that stage of the game.
Right, but there's one question in this connection going back to the war itself. The General Assembly passed a resolution relatively early calling for the establishment of a unified democratic Korea on the basis of free elections. According to Acheson's memoirs, he never interpreted that as meaning unification of Korea through military action, whereas General MacArthur did.
Yeah.
Now, was that, were you aware of this distinction at the time in response to that resolution?
Yeah, we were aware of it.
Yeah.
And we were worried about MacArthur, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was certainly also at the lower level, so to speak, at your level in the department, your interpretation also of the resolution was that it didn't mean unification through military force.
No.
No.
So.
Now, I have another question going back to an earlier period in the war, and that is when President Truman had his press conference in which he referred to the possible, or he did not exclude the possible utilization of atomic weapons in Korea. What was the reaction, in, again, at your level in the State Department to this statement?
Worry. I think that would be a single word answer to the question.
Yeah. Efforts were made in the department to correct the impression, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, but I was not aware of that.
And Mr. Attlee came very quickly to Washington. Mm-hmm. Was your office involved in that Attlee visit?
No.
It was not. No. That was done at the...
And there were three levels, after all. There was the secretary, there were the assistant secretaries, and there were the chiefs of the division. So that was up in the higher level.
Now, there was just one final question in this connection. One of the things that was very much on Attlee's mind, besides the atomic weapons, was this conviction that under no circumstances should the Korean War become a war between Asians and Europeans, so to speak. Was this also a concern in
yes.
the State Department?
Yes, definitely.
Something that you shared, actually. In other words, it didn't originate with Attlee.
No. It was a concern.
And would you say that that was also the intention of the U.S. government, to avoid any war of that nature?
Yes.
And this underlay perhaps the restrictions that were imposed on MacArthur as far as China. Good. Those actually are the main questions I have, but unless there is something that you would like to put on the record, so to speak, that you recall is particularly important in this connection.
No, I think that if the one thing that was disappointing for us at the lower levels was the fact that Hickerson, as the person who talked with the other nation's representatives, kept that so closely to himself. Mm-hmm. It was a real pain in the neck. And I think we were correctly critical, adversely critical, of the way that was handled. It was all one man. Now, he spoke to the secretary, of course, and that was the important thing, but it was too much in a single man's thing. It should not have been done that way. He should have had someone, Hickerson should have had someone with him every time he went to those meetings, which were held on a weekly basis, as I remember, weekly or bi-weekly.
Very good. Thank you very, very much.
Have you talked to Hickerson? Is he still alive?